WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Brenda Lee. Next month, she'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I liked her records when I was a kid, but it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized what a good singer she is.
All alone am I, ever since your goodbye. All alone with just the beat of my heart. People all around, but I don't hear a sound. Just the lonely beating of my heart.
That's Brenda Lee's 1962 recording, All Alone Am I, one of five Lee recordings that made it to the top 40 that year. She was 15 in 1960 when she had her first number one hit, I'm Sorry. That's also the year that Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree made the charts. You still hear it every year around the holidays. Brenda Lee has a new memoir called Little Miss Dynamite that describes what it was like to be a teen star in the early days of rock and roll. Brenda Lee was raised in a poor family in rural Georgia. She was performing on TV by the time she was six. At the age of 11, she signed with Decca Records and made her first recording, the Hank Williams song, Jambalaya. Brenda Lee learned the song from her mother and had been singing it since she was a little girl.
Goodbye, Joe. Me gotta go. Me on my own. Me gotta go. Pull the piro down the bayou. My Vaughn, sweetest one, oh my, oh. Son of a gun, we'll have a bigger fun on the bayou. Jambalaya, crawfish, pine, the filly gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna see my machete mio. Pick it up, fill fruit jar and be gay, oh. Son of a gun, we'll have a bigger fun on the bio.
Brenda Lee, you have that kind of like rockabilly hiccup in your voice on that recording. Is that something you were already doing? Is that something you were coached to do?
No, that's something that I was already doing. I was never coached in singing. I never took singing lessons until I was in my early teens, and I really didn't take singing lessons then. I went to New York and worked with a vocal coach on correct breathing and stuff like that, but I was never coached vocally.
So how did you start doing that hiccup kind of thing?
I don't know. That just came natural. That's along with the growl that I used to do, that I still do today. That just all was there.
You're from a poor family. Was there pressure on you to bring in the money and keep recording and, you know, make the money that your family didn't have?
I don't think there was any pressure. I never felt any. Once again, I was singing, which is what I love to do. And if I was making any money doing that, that was just an added attraction to the whole deal. And if it was helping my family, that was great. Later on, I knew that that the money was helping and that we needed the money. And so but it was always a pleasure for me. I was never pushed to. My dad died at an early age, when I was about seven, and I was never pushed to sing or to do any of those things. But I just always knew that that would help, and I wanted to help.
Now, you're right that there were restrictions on your money because you were a child. This was after you moved to Nashville. There were restrictions in the state of Tennessee protecting child performers from having their parents misuse the money. So what restrictions were put on the money that you were bringing in?
My mom was given a weekly salary, which was very low. It wasn't much at all. I think it was about $75 a week, if I'm not mistaken. And everything else went into the court and was looked over by a judge. And anything that I wanted to buy big, like I wanted to buy my mom a home, I had to go to the judge with my legal guardian and ask him to let me do that. And then he had to rule if it was okay or not. So everything was watched over, and nobody was able to abscond with any of the money.
So what kind of home did you buy her?
I bought her a nice home in a nice little suburb of Nashville. It was kind of a split-level type, two-story type home. It was very nice and had it all furnished, and she was very happy.
And you were living there, too?
I was living there, too.
Well, Brenda Lee, let's get to your first number one hit, I'm Sorry. What's the story behind the song? How did you end up recording this song?
The writer of I'm Sorry had written a song for me called Sweet Nothings, which was my really first big rock hit. And he had given me I'm Sorry before he had given me Sweet Nothings. And we had taken it to the record label, to the people there, and they really thought that the song was just a little bit too mature for me because I was only 14 at the time, going on 14 or somewhere thereabouts. But I loved the song, and I really believed in it. And every time we'd have a session, I'd say, let's do I'm Sorry, let's do I'm Sorry. And they'd say, no, we're not going to do that. So one night we were doing a session, and we had about 10 minutes, 15 minutes left. And I said, come on, let's do I'm Sorry. And Owen said, well, we don't even have an arrangement on it. And I said, that's okay. Just get the demo out. We'll play it for the guys here, the musicians, and we'll just all work together and put our heads together and come up with what we think it ought to be. And that's what we did. And we did two takes, and it came out and went to number one. And right now, I understand worldwide, it sold 15 million records.
Well, let's hear it. This is Brenda Lee's hit, I'm Sorry.
I'm sorry, so sorry. That I was such a fool. I didn't know love could be so cruel. Oh, 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 yes. You tell me mistakes are mine. Don't right the wrong that's been done.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
So sorry.
So sorry. Please accept my apology. But love is blind. Too blind to see.
Oh, 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 yes.
Brenda Lee's first number one hit, I'm Sorry, recorded in 1960. Brenda Lee, you know your oh yeah part? Excuse me for ruining it there. was that your idea to put that in? Was that written into the music or sung in the...
No, that was my idea. Uh-huh. And the song, we had to make the song longer because it's only an 8-bar song, and we had to make a 16-bar song, so that was the reason for the recitation. But the yes, that was my idea.
Works very well, very effective. I was going to ask you about the spoken bridge, so you put that in just to make the song longer?
Yeah, we needed the song to be longer, so we kind of sat around a minute, and Owen said, why don't we do a recitation? And I was all for that because I was a big Ink Spot fan, for those folks out there that remember the Ink Spots. And Mr. Williams, the lead singer of the Ink Spots, always used to do recitations like on songs like If I Didn't Care and things like that. So I thought that was a great idea.
My guest is Brenda Lee. She has a new memoir called Little Miss Dynamite. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Brenda Lee is my guest. She has a new memoir called Little Miss Dynamite, The Life and Times of Brenda Lee. I want to play another big hit of yours. This was your second number one hit, I Want to Be Wanted. How was this song chosen?
That song was an Italian song that we had translated into English. And we used to get a lot of foreign songs because I had courted the foreign market by going over and working in Europe and all over in Brazil and South America and all over South America, all over Europe. And I had courted those markets in the early days because I wasn't having any success in America. So I used to get an awful lot of foreign songs sent to me to be recorded, and I Want to Be Wanted was one of them.
It's a great recording. Let's hear it. This is Brenda Lee, recorded in 1960.
Alone, so alone that I could cry. I want to be wanted alone, watching lovers passing by. I want to be wanted. When I am kissed, I want his lips to really kiss me. When we're apart, I want his heart to really miss me. That's the way I want to be loved alone.
That's Brenda Lee, recorded in 1960. Brenda Lee has a new autobiography called Little Miss Dynamite. You were written up in a lot of the teen magazines when mm-hmm. you were 15 and afterwards. You say in your book that all your romances in your mid-teens were fake ones. They were just the things that were made up for publicity. Tell us about some of the fake romances with other teenage stars.
Well, let's see. There was Fabian. There was Bobby V. There was Tony Dow. Those are the ones I remember.
Tony Dow's the older brother on Leave It to Beaver.
That's right. And we had a layout one day, and you know, for a teen magazine, and it made the kids think that we had a romance going on. The same with Bobby V and the same with Fabian, but they were actually just my buddies. I wasn't even allowed to date at that time.
Who was it that was preventing you from dating?
My mom didn't allow me to date until I was 16, and then I was only allowed to double date. And I had my first single date with the guy that I married.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you also had a column called Brenda in Teensville. Where did the column run?
It ran in 16 Magazine, and that was a lot of fun to write that. We did little stories on beauty and tips for beauty for girls and dating and all that kind of stuff, and that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that.
Now, how could you give tips on dating if you weren't even allowed to date?
Well, I just gave what I thought, you know, that I would. I just said, you know, I'm not allowed to date, but if I were allowed to date, this is what I would do.
Uh-huh.
All the kids knew that I wasn't allowed to date. I never hid that from them.
Now, my memories of you are with one of those big bouffant hairdos of the 60s.
Oh, yes, yes. The big hair. I still have big hair. It's not as big, but it's big.
Why do you still have big hair?
I'm so short. I think it makes me look taller. So I just continue to keep it.
Brenda Lee is my guest. She has a new autobiography called Little Miss Dynamite. I want to play a recording that I think every American has to know. It would be impossible to have not heard this recording if you've lived through Christmas in America. And I'm thinking of Rocking Around the Christmas Tree. How did you end up recording this?
That song was written by a gentleman who is a dear friend of mine. He's passed away. His name was Johnny Marks, and he was out of New York. And he also wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Holly Jolly Christmas and several other Christmas standards. And he sent about 20 songs to me one time, and that was the only Christmas one in the whole group. And that was the one that I loved. And so we went into the studio, I believe it was in 1958, and recorded that and released it, and it just didn't do anything. And then after I had Sweet Nothings, the label released it again, at Christmas, and it did, you know, fairly well. But then after I'm Sorry, it started doing really, really great, and it's one of the top 10 Christmas songs of all time.
Why don't we hear it? This is Brenda Lee.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see, every couple tries to stop. Rocking around the Christmas tree, let the Christmas spirit ring.
Brenda Lee, I'm sure like every other American, you hear this many, many times every single Christmas. What goes through your mind when you hear it on the radio around Christmas?
I'm just overwhelmed that it's had the success that it has. I mean, I have people tell me it wouldn't be Christmas unless we played Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree, and that really makes me feel so good. And I believe, you know, the song is just a testament to the writer and the musicians that played on it, because it sounds to me just as good today as it did when we first recorded it. And of course, we recorded it, I think, on 3 tracks, which is, you know, we've come so far technically today, that's almost laughable. But I think it withstands the test of time.
Now, you did a lot of rock and roll shows as a teenager. You did the Murray the K mm-hmm. show at the Brooklyn Paramount. You mm-hmm. had your own touring show. What was it like for you to tour with the package shows with a lot of rock and roll performers?
I love that. Those are some of my fondest memories of doing the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, and then my own shows, which I would always have 2 or 3 acts on, and then the Brooklyn Paramount shows, because I am such a fan anyway, and I just love meeting all the other entertainers and standing in the wings and watching them work, and that was a lot of fun.
Who were some of the people who you worked with on those tours?
Oh, Chubby Checker, Dwayne Eddy, Fabian, the Bill Black Combo, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Connie Francis, the Beatles. Well, that came later. Elvis, Fats Domino.
And being one of the few females on the tour, you know, mm-hmm. were you dating yet? Were you old enough to date
No,
yet?
I was not dating yet. I was not dating. Still not dating.
So was there somebody to chaperone you or protect you, so to speak? I guess chaperoning isn't even the right word if you're not even going out on a date.
Well, my mom was always with me and my manager. And then I had my band, 6 boys, which were like my big brothers that watched over me. So I couldn't have gotten in too much trouble even if I'd wanted to.
So your mother traveled with you on the rock and roll tours?
Mm-hmm. Yes, my mother traveled with me till I married.
Was that uncomfortable for you? I know, like, when my girlfriends and I went to the Murray the K show when we were in, I don't know, junior high school or something, you know, one of the fathers would often drive us to the Brooklyn Paramount, but gosh, we wouldn't have wanted to be seen with him. And here you were performing in these shows with your mother traveling with you.
I know. Well, my mom was a good mom. You know, she's not a stage mother, never was, and she was always kind of always in the background. But I always knew, you know, if I got out of line and all that, she'd be right there. And she never pressured me or anything, so she was kind of like my best pal. We had a really good time on the road going to see things and sightseeing, and also it was a companion for me.
Now, you write in your memoir that you were forced to become a one-dimensional icon named Brenda Lee. You were supposed to devote yourself to being a star 24 hours a day. What were you supposed to do to be a star in your daily life?
Well, you know, for so many years, I just ate, breathed, and slept Brenda Lee, that I had no time for anything else. And that's what you had to do back then, because I was working almost 12 months a year. I was gone all the time. And that's what my manager and the people around me wanted me to do.
Brenda Lee, her new memoir is called Little Miss Dynamite. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Brenda Lee. Next month, she'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She has a new memoir called Little Miss Dynamite. Lee had her first number one hit, I'm Sorry, in 1960 when she was 15. Although she was famous for singing about love and regret, her mother wouldn't allow her to date until she was 16, and then she could only double date. Now, you said that the first person you dated was the man that you married. You were how old when you married?
I was 18 when I married.
And he was the same age?
He was 6 months older, yes. He was the same age.
Did your parents approve? Did your manager approve?
No, I didn't tell anybody. I eloped. Because I knew if I told anybody that they would talk me out of it and they would, they wouldn't let me do it. And I was so used to doing everything that I was told, and my mindset was such that I was so used to that, that I probably wouldn't have done it. And I knew that this was the guy that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. And I knew if I didn't go ahead and do it this way, that it probably would never happen.
Are you still married?
I'm still married 39 years later.
Now, you had a baby within a year of your marriage. It must have been very difficult to keep up the schedule you're supposed to keep up and be a mother.
It was very difficult. And I look back at that part of my life after I wrote the book. I really didn't realize how much that I was gone. And I don't have it anymore. I had a lot of guilt about that. I say in the book that after I had my baby girl, Julie, I left town when she was 3 weeks old, and when I came back, she was walking. So I'm not very proud of that.
I want to ask you about your manager, Dub Allbritton. What was his importance in your early career?
Well, he was so knowledgeable, and he had one vision, and that vision was me. And that I was his main focus. And he was so important to me during those early days because, as I said, I was his main focus.
Were you close with him?
Yes, I was close. He was like a father to me. I loved him dearly. I don't know that I ever felt, you know, that he really loved me as much as I loved him. I know he did. Our relationship was real contradictory in many, many ways.
Like what?
Well, just like that. Like, I never knew if he really cared for me as much as I cared for him. And then he would, you know, he would show it. He never would tell me, but he would show it by his work and his devotion to me in that area.
What do you think about when you see teenage performers who become big stars now, knowing what the experience was like for you when you were a teenager?
I just hope they keep their head on straight and they get their education, because I think education is a real biggie. And I just hope they don't have too many people pulling at them too many different ways, and that they wind up with the fruits of their labor.
Is keeping your head on straight a challenge when you're a young star?
Yes, it's a challenge when you're any age, but it's a real challenge when you're young.
Why is it so hard?
Well, because, you know, you start believing all these wonderful things that people are saying about you, and that can go to your head real quick, and it can change your personality and make you feel that you're maybe more important than you are. You just need to stay who you are. You don't need to be somebody else. That's why people gravitated toward you in the first place. It's because of who and what you were and are, and so you don't need to change that.
Do you have a favorite recording that you'd like to end with?
I love a song that I did called Johnny One Time.
And that's a song that Willie Nelson wrote.
He didn't write it, but he had the first recording on it.
Oh.
And I heard it going down the road one day. I heard him singing it, and I thought, boy, I love that song. I'd love to do a cut on that. And I was nominated for a Grammy for it, and it was a good record for me.
Do you remember what year this was recorded in?
I think it was 1969.
Well, we have it right here. Let's end with it. Brenda Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Brenda Lee's new autobiography is called Little Miss Dynamite, The Life and Times of Brenda Lee.
So he told you that you're the dream that he's been searching for. And he told you that he'd never met anyone like you before. And I can hear him telling you, your lips taste just like cherry wine. But did he tell you that he's known as Johnny One Time? Did he tell you that your heart would soon become another trinket on his bracelet of broken hearts? Did he tell you that the morning sun will find you patching up your shattered pride and searching for the missing parts? Did he tell you that the special love you're saving will disappear in flames, shame like mine? Did he tell you that he's known as Johnny One Time?
This is Fresh Air.